Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap. It is May the 17th of 2017. Oh, man. We've got a weird episode for you today.
Nick, did you hear the good news, though?
What's that?
Guess what's coming back to television, Nick? America's favorite family, Roseanne! I'm not waiting for you to guess. You're never going to get it. Roseanne's coming back, Nick! Yeah. With brand new episodes.
They're bringing back, like, every sitcom, aren't they? Like,
fingers crossed for a Golden Girls remake, Nick, with only 1/4 of the original cast still alive.
Just Betty White just sitting in a graveyard, just
crying in front of graves.
I'm not sure which is worse, if she's senile and imagining that they're there, or if she's just upset.
In front of their graves eating cheesecake, like, I wish you girls were still here. And I still watch every week. I'm like, maybe next week's episode's funnier.
Oh, Blanche, you're such a whore in the afterlife.
Maybe next week she needs, like, help doing a telethon and Blanche's ghost comes back or something.
Just recreate it with CGI, like in the Star Wars movies.
Oh, yeah. Everyone's like, wow, Estelle Getty looks great. I hope she's doing good. I'm like, guys, she's been dead for, like, 15 years. I don't know how to tell you this.
Oh, anyway, we're not topping that on the opening monologue. Let's just move on. We have a different suggestion that we are taking this week. It was an odd one that I saw while looking through our suggestions, and I was like, you know what? Why not? That could be Incarnate by Nick Simmons, Gene Simmons' son. Gene Simmons, the lead singer of legendary heavy metal band Kiss. Yeah, his son a few years ago published a comic book series. Well, he didn't publish it. He drew a comic book series, which was picked up by a publisher that, let's be honest, only picked it up because he's Gene Simmons' son.
You sure it wasn't for the riveting quality?
Oh, you know, that's a possibility. And we would probably have gone through our lives having never heard of this comic book if not for the fact that I think it got shown at like a Comic-Con, like a preview got shown at Comic-Con, people started noticing, hey, this looks remarkably familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Like, too remarkably for it to possibly be a coincidence familiar. And soon enough, the side-by-side comparisons got posted, and sure enough, it turned out that Nick Simmons had very blatantly traced a series of images, a lot of them from Bleach, apparently a few from DeviantArt, but those are obviously going to be less familiar to most people. And, yeah, so the comic was canceled, and I don't know how things ended up panning out, because details aren't really available, but obviously he hasn't published a comic since then, because, well, you saw how it worked out the first time.
I would say probably nothing of, like, very harsh significance happened, because I don't think he went to prison after it or anything. Like, I don't think he was forced to pay money out. It was probably just a very quiet, like, look, we won't, you know, pursue any action if this series just ended. Because this only ran for 3 issues.
Right.
And then not anymore since then. This is an interesting sort of series. Because I knew all this going into it. I was like, I knew the series had directly taken some shots out from Bleach. And I went in kind of trying to be as fair as I could. I was like, let's just see.
Right.
It very quickly turned me off in a different direction because, look, even if it didn't steal take anything from Bleach, this series was very clearly written by, like, a young, angsty boy because it's very heavy into this idea of, like, humans are scum. This world's so dark and miserable. Men are awful people. It's just like, oh, just fuck off, man. I don't know. What, did you write this when you were 12? It was just like a mentality I immediately had that just turned me off of, like, just such a weird worldview that's pushed down your throat immediately in this series before you even meet the main character.
It's essentially a vampire series, very much like late 90s, early 2000s vampire series. They're not vampires. They're demonic immortals that eat human flesh. But things don't really start off very strong because... What is his name? Mott, I think.
Mott is the name character. M-O-T. Mott.
Which... Okay.
It's not his true name, but you really... The series doesn't continue long enough for you to really get the whole story.
Who cares? Anyway, so... So, not Alucard from Helsing. He starts off with this opening monologue where he's just eating this guy in an alleyway. And for some reason, there's a wild wolf wandering the streets of this very obviously urban area. And it sees him eating a human. He's just like, fuck that, and walks away. For some reason, there was just a wolf there. The wolf never shows up again, but just a wild wolf in the middle of the city.
I think it was meant to be a dog, but there weren't any like accurate dogs to lift directly from Bleach for him to draw. So...
People draw wolves a lot, so. and he says, I don't feel, I'm too lazy to actually look up the exact page to get this exactly right, but it says, there's nothing but the overwhelming hunger, the overwhelming need to consume human flesh. I don't actually need to eat human flesh. I don't need to eat anything because I won't starve, but it's just... I get what you're going for there, where it's like, technically, I don't need any nutrition to survive, but there's this horrible demonic hunger inside me that compels me to kill and consume human flesh. But it's such awkwardly worded dialogue. And this is like the first or second page. So right away, it's like, oh, we're off to a great start if that's the level of in-depth insight that we're going to get from this.
This is like the first paragraph of the series. Humans kill each other. In every era, every empire, every city, they kill each other. For every reason. And no reason at all, they kill each other. In the beginning.
I mean, that's standard, the very beginning.
I took that standard in that.
That's standard and generic. But hey, it makes sense. You're accurate, at least, yes. You're saying nothing, but that's true.
Yeah. But it's then, like, no, the killing doesn't bother me anymore. It's the hunger. And it's just like, it's this idea that, like, the world is this awful place, so it's okay for him to be awful. It's just trying to play that idea of, like, a world of anti-heroes, like a Spawn, but... No, I guess it's just the Spawn. I was about to say Spawn without the maturity, but then I remembered one of Spawn's main antagonists is a rapist clown, so maybe I was giving Spawn a bit more credit than I should on first thought.
At least there is like a whole, I made an unwise deal with the devil and must now oppose Satan's army thing going on with Spawn. Like, at least he's a good guy.
Look, there's not a tremendous amount to actually talk about in this series. I guess it would be more so correct to just, like, kind of try to explain vaguely what it is. This is a very strange series because there's not a lot of context for what happens at all throughout the entire series. At the start, you meet this guy.
Who are they? What are they? What do they want? What does this organization want? Why... is one of them bad?
Like, after we meet Mott, we very quickly meet another guy who we aren't introduced to. He's just on the phone with somebody talking about how he's staying with a dad and a kid in, like, this rundown apartment with a corpse in it. Then he opens the door, someone shoots him in the face, and then he gets back up. And I'm like, so are these two supposed to be friends and Mott's just an asshole? Who is this guy? Like, you just sit there and you're like, do they do this for fun? Like, prank each other by trying to kill them? It's just this very confusing thing that you're sitting there. Like, I don't understand what these people are. They keep referring to it like, yeah, we are these people. And the humans, they are what they are. But it's our job to devour them. And I'm like, how many of them are there? Then they run into a whole group full of these people. And there's, like, an ancient Egyptian
dude. So they meet up at the Visored Warehouse with the rest of the Visored.
They meet up with fucking Shinji. The rest of the
Visors. They meet up with Shinji, Crocodile, Shoddy from Yu-Gi-Oh! Death from DC Comics, Solomon Grundy cosplaying a Scarecrow.
Like, I have to assume that the girl in that group is a character lifted from DeviantArt because she looks like she is.
Freaking pixie goth mohawk chick. Like, there is no way that just popped into your head.
She's trying very hard. Like, for somebody who's apparently lived for a very long time and feasts on humans, she's trying a wee bit too hard, basically.
And then there's Mott, who, like I said, is basically Alucard from Helsing, except he's a scrawny kid. When he's drawn as a scrawny kid, because sometimes he seems like he's like 7 feet tall. And then there is blonde Chad from Bleach. I too, like you, went into this being like, okay, you know, I know that there's examples of plagiarism through this. I know that there are characters who are lifted very clearly from other series. I know that there are going to definitely be panels where I'm like, oh, well, there's Zaraki doing that thing that Zaraki did, you know. But I was not prepared for how completely transparent every example of this is.
I, at the start, was like, I kind of see it, and I couldn't remember when this had happened, so I was like, maybe Shinji just wasn't that big of a story at that point. And it's only that first panel that really hits it hard when he has like a big grin.
That grin on his face, yeah.
And I was like, okay, it's not too bad. But then Zaraki shows up, and I'm like, holy shit, man, you didn't even try to hide this!
He's Zaraki with white hair, and he doesn't carry a sword around, he carries a bone scythe, a scythe made of bones. But it's not that he looks like Zaraki, and he's traced like Zaraki. He's just fucking Zaraki!
He just happens to be a battle-crazed fight monster who has a lot of attitude towards him, and does a lot of the same poses and grins and shit, and it's like, oh my god, why did you try?
And the whole thing about remembering his opponent's name is lifted fucking verbatim. It's so blatant.
And I was like, maybe it's just this one situation. Then blonde Orihime shows up, and I'm like, holy shit, man! So we're going to bounce all over the place, which is weird, because this isn't that long. But I have to comment on her, because she is mind-boggling to me.
I get her!
What the fuck is she? Like, so there's this group of characters, that they're called Revenants, essentially.
Yes.
The people that Mott and others are. And they're apparently like, they're gathering together because they're like, hey, the humans are hunting us. They're like, whatever, humans have always tried to hunt us, but they can't because we fucking immortal, man, whatever. And they're like, no, for real this time, they're actually able to hurt us. So a bunch of fucking SWAT guys come in, led by Zaraki, and they're starting to hurt them. And basically Mott and this other guy are kind of like left behind fighting. And then she shows up, this blonde Orihime, and she's like, I guess you boys are coming with me, and knocks them out, essentially to, like, put, like, the X-Men, like, you know, collar, like, bomb collar on them, and then be like, I guess you guys are going to be my bodyguards now. And I'm like, why? Who are you? Why are you doing this? Like, she goes from being this character who looks like she's, like, the leader of this mysterious organization to just being the, like, damsel in distress character who just has an attitude. It's just like, wait, I'm so confused. What are you?
Because she's so in control of the situation and so confident that she's just toying with them. Mm-hmm. She's teasing them and all this stuff. And it seems like, okay, you know, she's going to be this very... She's going to bounce off of Mott because it's a battle of personalities between them. Mott is defiant of everything. He's like, I'm so dark and edgy and you can't control me and I'll kill you all because I hate you all. I hate all you mortals because you just die. So I just want to get rid of you and your mortal stench and stuff. And she's like, oh, that's cute, you know. But then in like the entire third issue, all of a sudden she becomes this wilting flower. Who minor things happen, and Mott is forced to protect her because their bomb collars are linked to not only her command, but also her lifetimes. So they're forced to protect her.
Yeah, like, at what point you're like,
and,
is this like an Amanda Waller Suicide Squad kind of thing? Like, you're just going to have to work for me. But then just abruptly at one point, she's walking home and it's like, I'm going to kill you now. And she's like, oh my God, a random person I've never met before is going to kill me. And Mott kills that person. She's like, thank God you were here. You saved my life. And she's like,
and Mott's like, no. I don't actually care about you.
And she's, oh, but no, if you only understood how I feel.
Yeah, but then she comes up with this thing and she's like, why do you act like you don't care? And it's just like, I don't, what? You're not a nice person.
I know you care about me deep down and you just hide your true feelings behind that dark exterior.
When did you become this character?
I'm like, what happened? There's such a weird transition from the first time we eat you to just what happens after that.
I don't understand why you hate me just because I cut you open and had a bomb surgically implanted on your spine.
It's so strange. I can't grasp what happens to that character or anything involving her whatsoever. I mean, it's hard to not get irritated because every time you see her, just like, holy shit, I didn't realize how many times you could just trace Orihime, which is really flagrant because you could tell the times when there wasn't a working shot to trace from because her face will very abruptly change into something that doesn't resemble it.
Not just her face, not just her face, but her body too. She'll get randomly skinnier and smaller in a bunch of shots. There's a lot of occasions where things just suddenly appear off model because, like you said, they're not being traced anymore. So everything seems a lot sketchier and proportions don't work out as well as they were before. So also, then it turns out that the Revenants can transform, which is never alluded to before. Just the Egyptian one is just like, I'm going to turn into Anubis now.
Well, Nick, obviously they're releasing their Shikai and Bankai. Exactly. Yeah, they got it. They're transforming.
It's Resurrection because their bodies are transforming, so they're on guard.
Yeah, true. You got a point there. You know what? I do have an issue with, like, getting too hard on this comic because it is kind of clear from this that this is essentially a situation where a fan fiction was put and made into a comic, and it only was made and distributed as a comic because there was like a business idea behind a distributor saying, oh, hey, this is Gene Simmons' kid. That name value might sell some comics. Let's just, you know, print it. Because I feel like if, you know, Joe Schmo comes into to the distributor with this idea, they're going to be like, ah, I don't know about this. It seems really kind of weird. And I'm one of those people that tries not to shit too hard on fan fiction because it's like, it's what, you know, this is just passion project. People could write even if they aren't great writers. Sure. I'm not going to come on them down on them for that. But there is definitely a point here where you sit there and you're like, so many of these shots or cons, like attitudes, are just lifted right from other series that it's hard not to get a little bit angry at certain moments. Where you're just like, oh man, come on.
And, you know, in his defense, the guy is our age. Mm-hmm. So at the time this was published, he would have been 21 years old. That's really young to expect someone to do a fully published comic book series.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so I think that, honestly, the guy has got some creative potential in him.
This is something...
He hasn't... Yeah, you know, and young creators especially are inspired by the ideas of stuff that they like. That was one of the defenses that he actually came out with, which is like, you know, yeah, I've been inspired by a bunch of stuff. I didn't really intend to actually, like... just blatantly copy stuff. I was more inspired by it, which was a little weak when you were like, okay, this is literally just the exact same image of Zaraki laughing, though. But I get it. You know, you are inspired to, you know, write the type of manga that you like to read. And also, I feel like imitation is a great way to learn how to create your own stuff. Mm. Because it gets you in the process of, you know, what you can do with the idea. You aren't going to learn to do something original if you don't just try to do something and then just kind of learn from there.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, in reading this, although I came off the top and said, like, oh, man, this angsty fucking humans are all dark pieces of shit, like, kind of insinuation at the top. I do see the potential of turning this into something interesting. If you took out some of the more resembling aspects to other series and refined it, I'd be like, okay, there could be something interesting or at least entertaining here that could be worth refining. In and of itself, though, there's just too many moments where you're like, man, I feel like this was... Because this is, what, 7 years ago? So this was probably in, like, the middle of the Hueco Mundo arc. And you feel like this is a series written as though it was kind of already at that point. Where it's like, oh, shit, things got to be intense and heavy really early on. I'm like, I just don't know who these people are yet. I'm not worried for Orihime because I don't know who this Okiora is, basically. This Egyptian Anubis Okiora who showed up.
Oh, man. I mean, it's not really worth getting too angry about at all. And honestly, like, because there were some people who kind of pointed this out, because obviously this kicked up a lot of fuss in, you know, the Bleach fandom. Like, oh, how dare someone, you know, just blatantly copy Kubo's artwork like this. And so people kind of pointed out, you know, a lot of you are reading illegal scans of Bleach, and maybe you shouldn't do that.
Kubo Sensei's art is being taken!
I don't know if you've ever heard about Kubo's reaction to the whole thing.
What was that?
He posted on Twitter, he was like, oh, you know, thank you, everyone who alerted me about the whole thing. Honestly, I'm not too... He said something along the lines of, honestly, I'm not too concerned about my work being copied. I'm actually just really surprised to hear that Gene Simmons' son made a comic book.
And I think that is kind of the thing, because it's not malicious in any way. And again, this kid was 21 at the time or so, and there is just a part of you that says, like, you know, if I was given the opportunity at 21 years old to write a comic, I imagine you could definitely look at it and say, like, hey, a lot of these things feel a little bit, you know, lifted or familiar or a little bit, you know, lame even, or whatever kind of term you want to put out there, because you're unpolished at that point. And it's easy to kind of get angry at something like that. But, I mean, outside of the moments when it's deliberately just tracing something, you do feel like, hey, this is somebody who's inspired by work. They just didn't deviate enough from the original concept to make it acceptable, basically.
Okay, here are the tweets that he wrote. So, from yesterday night until this morning, there have been an amazing number of messages from overseas fans along the lines of, there's a manga imitating Bleach in America. Well, I had a look at the site, and I don't understand English that well, but I think that what's written there is something like, it's a manga drawn by Gene Simmons' son, Nick Simmons. The fact that Gene Simmons' son is a mangaka, then whether he's plagiarizing me or not. Kubo, you know.
He's just like, yeah, that sounds pretty cool.
Whatever. Look how awesome I look in sunglasses with my arm full. Nick Simmons, that's an awful name. He should call himself Tight Simmons, yeah.
Oh, he's just like, oh man, I should make an Iran card based off of Gene Simmons now.
Wait, shit, they're already dead.
Time to just make a bunch of nonsense Quincy names.
I'll just make another letter for the Quincy Army.
Delta 2.
What was the first Delta? Shit.
Oh, shit. Now I need another Delta. I'm like, wait. Even the Sigma, though, was supposed to just be another figment made up by Gremmy. He's like, oh, my God.
Look,
I forgot.
Gremmy's going to really... Look, Gremmy's really stupid. Shut up.
Gremmy forgot he also didn't make a Delta 1.
All right. So that's really all we've got to say.
So as for recommendation, it is an astonishing, you probably don't need to read this. But hey, if you want to, it's there. Just recognize exactly what it is. I don't know what else to really say on that.
No, not really.
But seriously, what the fuck is up with that Orihime maker? I don't get it.
All right. Let's move on to the recap portion of the manga recap with, we're going to start things off by, doing My Hero Academia. It looks like we're finally getting the end of the meeting of the different hero organizations. Still haven't seen that villain meeting. Or at least the end of it.
Yep.
So it's number 137, Restraint. And we see kind of the aftermath of the students, how everything is affecting them. They're back to just doing, you know, training at the academy. We see the end of the conversation that they had with Aizawa among themselves. And Aizawa said, okay, you know, listen, so with all this stuff going on, look, the three of you, indicating the big three, you guys are on par with some of the pros and better than some of them, but you guys, you're not going to be as heavily involved in all this because, you know, whatever. But he also says, with that in mind, you know, you guys don't actually have to stick around with this. You know, you didn't really volunteer for this mission, so if you don't want to get involved, then you don't have to. But Uraka and Suyu and Kirishima are of course, all willing to do whatever they can to help out. And, that's basically it, honestly.
They don't have too much more to say. Right. They all have their own ways of being like, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
And I find myself...
Uraka's nervous, and Suyu's like, cool. And Kirishima's like, yeah!
I found myself being more and more enamored by Kirishima. I guess it's just because he's been in the magazine more frequently recently, so you kind of get exposed to him more. But I'm just like, oh, man, Kirishima is awesome. And then I'm going to be exactly like my feelings on Ida when he's like, oh, he doesn't do anything for a while. I'm so sad.
But Ida shows up right here, Chris.
Yeah, Deku's like, I don't care about your advice. Fuck you. And I'm just like, fuck you, Deku. You got to care about this man's advice.
Yeah, Deku is clearly still worrying about the whole thing where they had the opportunity to save Eri and they didn't. Ida realizes that something is wrong and he's like, hey, you know, are you all right? And Deku's not really willing to talk about it. And Ida says, hey, remember, you know, if it ever gets to be too much and you need to talk, just say something. I'm your friend. Because, you know, that's what you told me back then when I was acting strange. So, you know, I'm going to give you the chance to do it. Deku's like, don't fucking turn my advice back on me. I don't fucking need... Shut up. I mean, it's essentially like, I can't talk to you about it because it's fucking classified information, but...
Curiously. Yeah. So, Ida says this. If it ever gets too much, you need to talk to say something. And he like does like this. For some reason doing this, the sound effect is zing. So he's like, if you ever need something, I'm your friend. Zing! I'm like, what is causing the zing sound effect?
I don't know, he's got super speed powers.
I guess so, but I'd expect maybe more speed lines to indicate he's like, bzink! Instead it just sounds like he's like, hey Deku, I'm here for you, buddy. Bzinga. Like he just says it under his breath at the end.
Oh no, he's turning into Sheldon Cooper.
He's like, boink, 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 boink.
I don't understand women. So... some time goes by. Investigation goes on. The students all get notifications from the internship organizations, and the big three get the word, along with everyone else, that Eri is at the headquarters that they already knew about, and they're like, "Oh, so." We didn't need to even bother looking into all those different locations. Okay, then. How'd you find out about this? And what follows is such a bizarre little story. Because Sir Night Eye is like, well, this one weird guy from the Shie Hasukai was at a department store the other day purchasing this toy for young girls, and he just puts out this still-in-the-box toy. And they're like, oh... okay, well, but still, the guy could be a collector, I guess, you know, because there are some, you know, weird otaku out there who do that. No, you see, personal interest in the product, he wouldn't have been speaking the way he was. And he goes into this explanation about that, how the guy just, like, was completely unfamiliar with it, and Naida pretended to be this hideous otaku and ask him questions, and he was like, yeah, whatever, you know, just, like, cute, girly toy.
Yeah, it's like this weird sequence where Fat Gum's just like, he's like defending it. He's like, hey, some guys just like ponies. It's perfectly fine. There's nothing weird about it. Ah! I'm like, this is...
I don't want to fuck the horse.
You're like, you're getting way too angry and defensive immediately on this, first of all, dude. But then it is, yeah, he's just like, it could have been very simple. It'd been like, no, I know he wasn't a fan because he had to ask the cashier about what he was buying or something. Like, he had to ask a question because he wasn't sure. But instead, it's like this whole series of like, oh no, it's like about this spin-off series that he didn't quite understand, and I had to pretend to be a fan to walk up to him and be like, I'm like, look, couldn't you just say like, oh, I heard him say the wrong name, and then I fucking future sighted him and realized he was a dickhead, and I found it based off of that. Seems like it'd have been a lot easier.
And I was like, yeah, you know, I only use my foresight, like I said, when I've got, you know, to freaking, yeah. Also, I do like that they point out, like, you afterwards, you didn't actually need to purchase the item, though, because he's got it there with him, so he can point to it and be like, he was looking for this. He actually fucking bought it.
He's like, as though it were conclusive evidence, like, he was just like, take that, dude, they're just like, you know, he didn't, I mean, you could have believed you. You could have put up a picture.
Like, yeah, just, I mean, it's there advertised online. You could have just looked it up.
He's like, no. You wouldn't have believed me.
So everyone's getting hyped up and ready to go. We see, like, an image of Bubble Girl with
JoJo
her
posing?
Make ready pose, which is like this.
It's a JoJo pose. It's
It looks so uncomfortable, though.
I mean, the woman is wearing a shirt that stops at nipple height. I'm assuming she doesn't care about discomfort in her life. That's fine. She's probably, it's part like a secondary power of hers to just be immune to it, I guess.
So, Mirio and Deku get hyped up and ready to go and get this awesome two-page spread of the heroes and their apprentices all getting ready to go. It's a really cool group shot.
So, yeah.
That's the end of chapter.
I guess, presumably, we will be finding out next week, or maybe the week after. I'm seeing her, I'm just like, what the fuck is happening at that villain meeting?
Tell me!
I want to know, god damn it! But I presume we'll find out next time. I like this chapter, though. It was fine. This was kind of a chapter that needed to fill in the gaps, so to speak. And although we kind of questioned some of Night Eye's excessive thoroughness in both the explanation and delivery of his news, I still appreciate it kind of filling in the gaps as we get ready for this big mission.
Sir Night Eye is just pointing at the president and being like, see, what I think is happening is that they're getting these presents for this little girl, but they keep the presents in the box because, you know, she doesn't actually want to play with them because she's miserable. So they probably don't understand that he's miserable.
Oh, he just becomes the guard now, too, where he's just like, he doesn't understand the process. He's like, God, little girls are so complicated, hard to understand. I purchased this entire line of toys, and I know all of its intricate details, but I just don't understand what children do.
Do they have no appreciation for the fact that this model came out in 2007, but this model came out in late 2007?
This is an early model of this version where it didn't have the S on the side crossed off because it wasn't actually a pluralized form they were supposed to be using before the localization changes came into effect. This is like buying a One Piece volume where it was still said Zoro at the beginning before it changed to represent Zolo in the 4Kids translation. Those things should be worth millions! Like, Sir Night Eye, please. One, you're breaking the fourth wall. You're not supposed to realize Shonen Jump exists. Two, I don't really know if those exist. Three, calm down. Stop standing on your desk.
This is what I do when I in the 24 hours when I can't use my power.
I get really angry. It's overly emotional about things. Like he does. He screams during Law and Order. Screams. God damn it, Stabler, there's 40 minutes in this episode! You know this can't be the guy! Sir, Stabler hasn't been on Law & Order SVU in several years.
Bubble Girl's like, shut up or else he'll lock me in the tickle machine.
That's how he gets his... He's either getting really upset about nothing or being perverted. It's one of the two.
I told you it's how I believe that All Might is important in the world.
He's like, look, if I'm not saving the world, I'm creating fetish videos to blackmail you with later on in life. That's right, I'm the guy from the Tickle documentary.
Chris Matthews comes in. Why don't you take a seat over there? And he's just like, this episode was a bad one.
Oh, man. You got top.
I don't believe that this actually happened.
All right. Let's move on to Fairy Tale. Fairy Tale, chapter 535, The Greatest Power. And our cover page is a look back at what I believe is the Fighting Festival arc. My favorite arc, wink, wink, in Fairy Tale. God, that thing's terrible.
Means so much, Chris.
One day I want to do like a retrospective on that arc just to explain how god awful it was.
Arc alone.
it was where the complete 180 of Fairy Tale like happened. Where I'm just like, holy shit, this is awful. Like, immediately, this is terrible now. So, last time, Lucy had begun making changes to Natsu's book writing, essentially, to bring him back after being defeated by Xerath. And at the very end, it looked like it was hurting her in some way. She was paralyzed. There were, like, you know, visible veins running through her body that looked to be kind of paralyzing her. And as we start this week, we can see they actually are quite damaging, because after like 4 pages of like motionless Lucy, she finally just goes, ow, like in one panel. And I was like, I feel like it should have been bigger than that. Like, I know there's like a panel before where she's like trembling and like being like, but then it's like all climaxed with one ow. And I'm like, I feel like there should be more to that.
It's like that girl in the Baron Amatsuri.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like one short ow. It's like, I feel like that's the response you have when you're like, oh, I was walking up the stairs and I just fucked up my stepping and I accidentally kicked the step in front of me. You're like, ow, god damn it, that hurt. Not like, oh, this magic book's trying to kill me.
I don't know if it's Fairy Tale just having worn me down at this point or what, but while you've been talking about this, I've been looking at this and being like, how was the... Was this intended to be sexual?
I mean,
probably.
There's definitely...
that one panel where she goes out, it's like, that looks... That kind of looks like she's supposed to be sitting on a dick right there. Like,
I mean, there's enough of the panel shown that you could see a little bit up her skirt, and that's...
Yeah.
That's not, like, a mistake. It's not like it was a full body shot and it was, like, just cropped poorly. Hero deliberately chose to draw it to that extent that you see just a little bit up her skirt, and then it gets a shot from underneath.
Later on, you see her from above, and so you see the fact that her skirt's riding a little low, so her ass crack is showing. It's like, come on! She's like, being corrupted by awful, evil magic to save her friend, and you're just being like, look at that ass and tits! Just, come on!
Hey, look, there's an audience here. They're coming to Fairy Tale for some reason, and Hero's gonna cater to it. You know, you gotta respect that hustle. Following that is actually a moment I kinda like, wherein Gray tends to Lucy and he realizes that she's burning up. And it makes sense. She's essentially having Natsu's fire kind of burn into her. This flame of the demon is just kind of incinerating her from the inside out as she's trying to cure this magic. And she's thinking to herself, you know, this hurts, but this could be another clue to understanding this magic, to helping Natsu. And in response, Gray starts to cast his ice magic to cool her down basically a bit and say, you know, let's save Natsu together. And I like that. I like this idea of, one, it does play more to that imagery that's kind of always existed between Natsu and Gray's rivalry of fire and ice. It plays into that a lot. But I just like this idea that Gray is going to have this moment too to help Natsu. He doesn't need to have a big fight necessarily, although, you know, he kind of already had one. But just the idea he can help without having to find some opponent to beat. I like that element.
And this is... This chapter ends up having, like, one of, like, the first We Are Fairy Tale, Friendship Forever speeches from Natsu that feels justified in a while. Honestly.
It does. So Natsu, as we cut back to the thing with Xerath. Now, this was a little bit strange, and maybe I just had to read last week's to get the context again. Last week, Natsu kind of had a moment where he spoke to Xerath when Xerath was hanging out that door. It is, like, 80 steps to get out 10 feet. The speech he was doing, where he said, like, if you go out those doors, you have to come back alive. And it almost sounded like he was saying, like, in, like, a positive way, like, hey, if you're going out, you better not come back dead or something like that. Maybe it was him saying, like, that's the only intention for it, and you don't deserve to go out those doors. I didn't get the sense that he was angry in that moment, per se, like, in that attitude. But when he gets up, as he does now, it's immediately like, let's continue this fight, buddy, because I'm ready to go round two, ding, ding. I didn't hear no bell, you know? Zaref is noting, like, how is his injury recovering? Are they messing with the book? But there's no way. Even if one could do that, they would be corrupted by it and plunged into darkness. And he's like, whatever. I'll defeat you anyway, because I'm totes the best. Yeah, I'm,
oh, well.
I'm limitless magic. Unlimited power. But Natsu... Natsu just says, thank you. And he realizes what Gramps was talking about all the time, about how in that moment when things were really getting so rough, he was blowing up at Gray, and past that, when everyone needed him, he was being selfish, and he forgot why they were fighting, and his fists light up, and he stomps the ground, and he says, this is all for Fairy Tale. That's what gives us our final power. The greatest power! Cut away. And Jalal is fighting against Acnologia. And I don't know why it bothers me so much, but like when Acnologia revealed, like, I am the dragon of magic. I can consume and defeat all magic, essentially. I'm immune to magic, essentially. And he's like, oh, this pesky human. I just can't get him. I'm like, God, I feel like this guy should be stronger than this. Tangent, Nick. I had some free time today, so I was watching some of the Legends of Tomorrow show, and in this most recent season, they had the bad guys be the Legion of Doom, which was essentially just made up of villains in the Flash and Arrow shows that had been defeated over time, but like because
The B Squad, Legion of Doom.
Yeah, but
where they have to take from the Super Friends cartoon, it's like we got Cheetah and Captain Cold. And the Riddler, and that's it.
Captain Cold would have been A-list in that team, although he does join at the very end. But the big leader of it is Reverse Flash. And Reverse Flash has all the powers of Flash, crazy powerful, and it all comes down to this point at the end of it where they have this spear that could rewrite reality, and the heroes are trying to prevent the villains from basically getting their hands on it. So Reverse Flash shows up, bringing back 30 other versions of himself from the past to fight alongside himself against 7 or so people, most of which don't have powers. And it's like, all right, so all one of these Flashes needs to do is grab that staff. And like 5 minutes passes and they're too busy being like, this one guy hardens his body like steel. We can't get past him to get the staff. And I just sit there the entire
time. Go around him!
I'm like, how does no one, there's like 30 of you. How does one of you guys just grab the staff? There's so many. Just one of you do this. I have that same anger right here where I'm just like, how is Acnologia just like not slapping this guy? It's just, come on.
I can't push open this door that says pull.
It's like, can't you eat magic? Can't you just eat his flying magic that he's using and he falls to the ocean and dies? I don't know. Anyway.
Which he does at least start to do.
Yeah, he does actually finally, grab him and is, tearing him apart, and the ship's starting to fall into the ocean, and things don't look great for them. We won't have time to get to that this week. We cut back to the Zaref fight, and Zaref and, Natsu are fighting, and Natsu's saying, I won't stop till everyone can kick back together and laugh again, and Zaref's like, but that's what I'm doing, you jerk! And Natsu's like, no, you ain't. You ain't thinking about anybody but yourself. All you're doing is rejecting the world that's here. And Natsu says, burn it all! Everything that I am, the power of the guild will fuel my fame! And Zaref... and in return, Zaref says, then I will turn my darkness to power, my curse, my rage, my sorrow, hair flipped to the
burning
side.
Finger!
And they basically both are channeling their full page attack in very gratuitous Japanese that I'm not going to bother trying to scroll down to read the English translation. Yeah, I'm like, I'm assuming it's like fire fisty part thing and darkness blasty hurt thing. And that's essentially where... yeah.
Darkness blasty hurt thing.
That's why. If I get superpower, if I become an anime neck, that's what my special attack's gonna be. Darkness blasty hurt. If I become an anime. Look, it's slowly happy on this season of Dice Funk. Don't test me on this. I can't spoil that, but I'm slowly becoming a Super Saiyan in that game.
Fire Dragon King's Demolishing Strike.
That's essentially the chapter. They're both coming at each other, and it ends in, like, what I presume is the clash of the two attacks. So, who knows what happens, Nick? Maybe Xerath has been defeated.
Anyway.
This is, by and large, a fine chapter of Fairy Tale. I like that there was the moment with Gray, you know. I think the only thing that irritates me is just, like, Jaleel. Like, I can understand it in the concept of what this series is. Jaleel is supposed to be a big deal, so Jaleel kind of giving everything to try to hold off this beast does make sense. But I just, like, sit there and I'm just like, if Acnologia controls all magic, why doesn't he just, like, eat Jaleel's flying magic and just crush him in one attack? Or just swat him? Like, I feel like it's so weird. One person's holding him back. But that's a minor nitpick in the grand scheme of things. And I enjoyed this.
Oh, chapter. I can't shoot this fly with my gun.
But yeah, that's
if only I had some sort of larger swatty thing.
Some kind of automated fly swatter mechanic.
I will admit that, like, because it seems as though the series is trying to tease you with, oh no, Jalal might fall into the abyss and be trapped between time along with Acnology, and then Urza will be sad. And I was just like, oh no, not Jalal.
My God.
No.
I'm sitting here and I'm trying to remember what happened to that Mr. Siegfried in Rave Master, and I feel like it may have been a very similar circumstance that happened. And now as I'm saying it, I'm like, oh my God, is this dude going to show up for a third time in the next fucking series, Hero Draws, and be a big deal again? Like, I'm sitting there, I'm like, what happened to this? Hold on, I need to look this up, because now I'm going to be really annoyed.
You want me to start us up on Astro?
You get that up.
All right. Astro lost in space. So, continuing on from the crew's efforts to combine the two ships together so that they could set off again, we see that basically their work went off without a hitch. All the docking is complete, and everyone is like, yay! Everyone is happy. Tears of joy are shed. Laughter is had, etc. Kanata says, oh, you know, it's like my survival tip number 5. Once you give up, it's game over. And Lucas and me like, you gave up. We heard you. there's some very funny little one-liners that happen in this opening bit.
Okay, he does
get an explanation.
It doesn't exactly fall that way in Rape Master, but it's similar in the extent of like an idea of like kind of being trapped but nobly doing it in a sacrifice thing.
Right. Was that like his like final fate in that series? Like he was just trapped forever?
Well, no. Yes and no. I mean, he's not trapped for all eternity, but he dies naturally in the process of doing it.
Gotcha.
They essentially find his skeleton later on, what I mean.
Gotcha then. All right. Charse goes over some of the discoveries that he has made while they've been working on the ship, namely that the flora of the world have pulses. They have some sort of organ that functions as a heart, and they can also move slowly. So people are like, doesn't that mean that they're not actually plants then, but they're animals? And he says, no, because they actually, you know, do photosynthesis. So they're a plant-like animal or an animal-like plant. They're a sort of in-between. And so at this point, Luca's like, oh, well, you know, that's kind of like me. Who cares if things blur the lines a little anyway? Boy, girl, plant, animal, sci-fi, survival thriller, heartwarming gag manga. Which is fucking hilarious.
It's just great. But like a moment, you're just like, I don't know if it's exactly like that, but I...
Wait, did you? Yeah, you did. What the fuck? And I'm just like, what are you talking about?
It is a moment where I'm just like, Luke is slowly becoming like everything in this series. Like, you're just like, I really just come to this manga for Luca when you get right down to it.
Oh man, love Luca. Charles shares his killer strategy to counter the attacking plants, which is, if we need to slow them down, we just need to toss a dark tarp over them.
You know, I can understand that.
It makes perfect sense. It's like they don't have any photosynthesis, so they get less energetic. So but apparently he tested this by just going out and trying to wrestle some of the man-sized plants while Olgar stood guard with a gun pointed on them.
I do love that visual image of, like, a plant slowly killing him, like, eating him, and you just see fucking the other guy in the background with a gun held up to it. But, like, Charles has such a fun face.
He hasn't asked for help yet. I'm sure he'll be okay.
Yeah, Charles has such a happy face. He's just like, hey, what are you gonna do?
So the group splits up because they do need to spend about a week gathering supplies so that they can set up for the next planet. They're going to be able to do so, but, you know, they can't set off right away. So the group splits off, and for the rest of the chapter, we focus on Zack and Kitori, who have gone off on their own. We see Kitori implementing the dark tarp strategy, and essentially, like, one of them tries to bite her, and she's like, ah, gross! Throws the dark tarp on. He's like, oh, that worked. Picks it up. Ah, it's gross!
It's also very similar to young, like, 8-year-old Christopher's strategy to dealing with insects. Like, eventually I just grew to the point where I didn't care, but as a kid, I'd, like, if I saw, like, a millipede in my room, it would, like, I'd, like, pick up a dictionary and, like, slowly walk towards it. Then from, like, 20 feet away, just hurl the dictionary at it, like, ah! Be like, why did you bother? Like, and then pick it up slowly, like, as though it were going to crawl out and attack me if I lift up too much at once.
So Zack and Kitori stop to have some tea because they need to stay warm in the climate. And so Kitori, because they're alone, she kind of starts to get close to him, and she leans on his shoulder. And Zack's like, it's hard to eat like this.
Hit that immediate, like, robotic response. He's like, this is inappropriate positioning for eating, for the consumption of food.
This is not ideal for a meal. So, Kitori starts to kind of grill Zack because she says, hey, you know, when it looked like we were going to be stuck on this planet, you said, let's live together. And, you know, I caught what you were up onto there. I know what you really meant. Come on, fess up. What were you really trying to say? And Zack's like, what? She's like, no. What? And Zack's like, no. If we couldn't repair the ship, we could all live here together. And Kitori, you know, he's like, oh, and Tsundere is out on him, calls him a muscle-bound, marble-hearted, myopic, moronic meathead, which, well done on that alliteration. That's great.
I feel like this needs to be a contest somewhere, like the next...
Welcome to muscle-bound, marble-hearted, myopic, moronic meathead!
Well, it's like, if you were to do, like, the voice, but for, like, you know, the search for the next great tsundere. This is the, like, this is the opening challenge. It's like, all right, here's the line. Now you deliver it. It's like, you muscle-bound, marble-headed, myopic, moronic meathead. And they're like, a little shaky, a little pitchy in the middle there, dog. I don't know if you really put everything into it.
I didn't really feel you.
I didn't really feel that you care for him, but you're not going to put it. Oh, no, the NWO's attacking.
One of us is British and sardonic for some reason. That was the worst tsundere acting that I have ever seen. You should just go back to gushing over everyone.
And then because neither of us have a good Paul Abdul, Edwin is there and he's just like, I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. You're adorable, honey.
I really sensed how into it you were and I felt your passion.
I felt that you love him, but you put up an aggressive exterior because you don't like people getting to your heart of you. I love that.
Give me another line.
Oh, I'm stalkered. I just get shit-faced every week and pass everyone.
And then for some reason, Howard Stern just shows up to replace one of them. He's like, what the fuck are you doing here?
He's just like, I want you to make $5. Take off your shirt. Everyone's like, all right. I don't know what
else
I'm expecting.
I want to. All right, you're in.
It's like, ah, well, if you had Howard Stern in your show, you had to expect this to happen.
Anyway. Zach, kind of switches gears, cause Keith Reese says, like, well, you know, I guess, you know, I'm glad that we're able to set off and go back home because there's no way that I would really be able to achieve my dream if we were stuck here. And Zach's like, oh yeah, that's, you wanted to be a doctor. And Keith Reese's like, well, yeah, but you know, it was something else. Anyway, what about you, Zach? And, we get a bit more insight into Zach's backstory here. It's particularly with his relationship to his father, whom we know already. And you know, some of the projects that he was involved with. And there's kind of just like a very nominal explanation of what he was involved with, which, was memory transferal, which there's no real deeper explanation beyond he was working on this project. But it seems like that's gotta be something that's going to come up later. Cause we know that, you know, his father was involved in the circle of, their parents and stuff. That's a pretty big deal. And, I can't imagine that not coming into play later on. But anyway, getting into the emotional aspect of it, working on the project, essentially, Zach explains, caused him to grow distant. And, this is explained in a flashback where Zach drew, you know, as a kid drew this, you know, portrait of his dad, which was pretty good for, you know, a kid to draw. You know, it's, I mean, I'm pretty sure that if I drew this exact same picture, it would come out worse. So.
I'm like, as a full grown adult, I guarantee I couldn't draw something even one fifth as good as that. I'd sit there the entire time. I'm like, how do you draw ears? I don't get it.
So, there was this kind of awkward moment where Zach and his father just kind of, like, are staring at each other. He's like, oh, you drew this in school. This almost token smile and, you know, pats him on the head. It's like, very good. Thanks for the present, Zach. And then later on at night, Zach was wandering around the house, saw that he had thrown the drawing in the trash.
And I'm just sitting there like, lucky damn Zach, you had a dad to give presents to.
Wow.
I have to one-up him, Nick.
So, Zach's narration says, there are parents who don't care for their children, but that never particularly bothered me. It's just his eyes. He looked at me as he would at a doll. There was neither hate nor love in those eyes. They were as dull and empty as glass orbs without the faintest glimmer of emotion. Any emotion. That project changed him. And from this, Zach says, so that's why I don't want to follow the exact same path as my father. I don't want to end up the way that he did. So, you know, I've promised Kanata that I'm going to be his pilot when he becomes the captain of his own ship. And so when that happens, yeah, you know, I don't know exactly when it will happen, but that's my dream right now. And Keitri says, yeah, well, I also hope that I can make my real dream come true. And Zach's like, your real dream? But why don't you pursue it? What is stopping you? And Keitri is like, oh, no, forget about it. Being a doctor is what your mom wants of you. If you have a dream of your own, I will support you to the fullest of my ability. Remember the survival tip number 5. Once you give up, it is game over. And Keitri is just like, oh! Just snaps at him and says, my real dream is not going to happen. I know it's not going to happen because it stares me in the face every time you open your mouth. Because every time you're talking about you, because my real dream, in case you haven't guessed, is to be your bride, you idiot. And Zach just kind of stares at her for a second, and Keitri realizes, oh, fuck, what did I just do? And then Zach's like, what? And then Keitri's like,
this is
this guy!
this is incomprehensible. It does not compute. We had already agreed to be married at one point earlier in our lives. It's just like, God,
wait, what?
Damn
but,
it.
But we were children. Nobody like keeps those promises. And Zach's like, what? No, but we promised that. I still intend to keep that promise. And Keitri says, like, but marriage? You know, wait, I mean, you know, that's kind of really jumping to the end. I mean, you know, shouldn't you like be in, you know, like love each other? And Zach's, I've been in love with you for years. And the whole thing, of course, ends with Kitori just shouting out, "You have no right, and I mean no right, to complain about your dad's expression on his eyes." And, yeah, so...
It ends
and
literally...
And that's how they got together.
Yeah, it ends on the thing of, like, today, Zach and Kitori got engaged. Credits. It's like, what a strange, like, it's enjoyable and heartwarming. It's such a weird departure from the last couple chapters that have all been, like, something's happening. Something weird's going on. Everything's building up. It's like, let's deal with that later. Let's have some fun with these kids.
I fucking love it, though. It's so quirky and funny, and I do really like the way that they bounce off of each other. And yeah, it was actually kind of cute, honestly. So yeah, loved it. We can go home now. Anyway, so it turns out the robot loves you, Kitori. Let's move on to Food Force. All right, so last time we got the judges declaring that one of the two soba dishes presented by Kinokuni and Soma was able to have a much stronger flavor than the other, which completely perplexed them. So we get the explanation this time. in chapter 214, what makes the strong? And so the female judge says, so... Miss Kinokuni, there is a proverb that springs to mind. There is a... She takes a book out. The proof is in... What is it? The proof of the pudding is in the eating. That's what it is. And someone's like, oh, she doesn't just have the freaking taste Bibles there. There's a bunch of other ones. And there's like a stack of books. And one is just the big book of idioms.
Which is weird, because it's not the book she's reading.
No!
So she has more than one big book of idioms.
But she points out, hey, so Miss Kinokuni, you should taste the leftover soba noodles you had. And Kinokuni's like, I don't want to taste soba noodles. No. Taste your own soba noodles. He's like, but, all right, it's perfect. I know it's perfect. She tastes it. And then she goes, hang on a second.
Ah, crap.
And the female judge says, ah, you are sensing that something is wrong. They are not as fragrant as the ones that they usually make. But Mr. Yukihira's noodles maintained a much more direct buckwheat flavor. And we get this long explanation that it says that what it comes down to is the fact that because they're in Hokkaido and because they're in a wide open arena, it's much colder. There's much colder ambient temperature in the room. And as a result of that, it caused the aroma to disperse as a result. So because of this, the process that Soma did allowed the flavor to be more easily retained within that temperature. What this all comes down to is because, you know, Kinokuni is objecting, like, so he must have just, you know, lucked into happening to choose a technique that worked this way. And Ishiki shuts her down and says, no, Soma planned about this from the beginning. And Soma explains, well, you know, I didn't know why this was happening, and I didn't actually realize this from the very beginning, but when I was experimenting, I realized that the strength of the flavor wasn't as good, and that's when I came up with this, my idea to fry the dish in order to actually get the up to par it should be. Whereas Kinokuni made her perfect soba noodles the perfect way that she always does, and as a result, it did not adapt to the situation that they had landed in. So one was practiced and refined and stringent, and the other was flexible and adapted. And of course, that perfectly reflects the whole thing that's going on between Azami's group and Soma's resistance. So, makes sense.
Yeah.
Kinokuni is obviously angry and frustrated and perplexed. And so approaches someone and says, how did you do this? You know, what taught you to think this way? I don't get it. And Soma says, what are you talking about? Serving customers on a daily basis is a serious competition under mega pressure. You got to think about that stuff. And Ishiki has this inter monologue that says, so, you know, That's the difference between you and him. You aren't thinking of the person that you're serving when you're making the dish. You're just concerned with making it perfectly, whereas he's always trying to make it the best it possibly can be under each individual circumstance so that each of the customers enjoys it, and that's what makes him so strong. And Soma is declared the winner, and Soma whips his headband off, and he's like, yeah, happy to serve. Kiyokuni tries some of Soma's noodles, and her clothes blow off. Because I guess we waited long enough for that to happen,
Look, guys, we are what we are, right? She's going to have to get naked at some point.
I emphasized her butt earlier, so here it is naked.
There you go. All right, you got all you wanted. Hey, you know what? At least we don't have to sit here and say, like, who knows what'll happen, but, like, you know, for real, we all know Soma's going to win this one. He has to win this one.
I mean, I'm happy with the explanation, but it's something that it's not really a twist, but it's consistent with the message of what's been going on so far. So it's appropriate. I hope that things just kind of like, I hope that this is really just the baseline for all these matches in the team competition, because it wasn't particularly impressive for Shokugeki no Soma.
It is, and at one point, on the other hand, I actually really like this conclusion a lot, because I find Soma's victories tend far too often to be like, hold on, there's a secret surprise and trick to my food. Whereas this one, it was like, no, Soma just was highly considerate of every part of his food, because he's more concerned with the customers than the perfection of the food itself, you know? And that's where she got caught up. And it's almost this idea that, like, had it not been a contest of Soba, then maybe Kinokuni would have fared better, because she wouldn't have been so obsessed with her own perfect technique for this stuff.
It is a neat twist that her specialty ended up being her undoing. It's a nice way of going about it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that, and I do like the explanation Soma has, and I always appreciate the bluntness now. Because, you know, like, just Soma's way of being like, but you gotta think about that stuff. And it does go to show, like, Soma's background of being this, family restaurant cook has always kind of been his big thing in a lot of these moments. He's always talking about how he does this for his customers. And it's just, like, the bluntness of that delivery just kind of works. I like the way that this all kind of ended. But at the same time, I'm also like, all right, I'm ready to move on to something else. Something with maybe a little bit more ambiguity towards what the final result's going to be.
Yeah. Waiting on baseball hat guy to beat Megashima.
That'd be fucking crazy.
All right. Let's move on to Dr. Stone, Z equals 10, student of science. So this is mostly a flashback chapter going into Senku's childhood. And but it starts off with Senku in class. You know, everyone is talking about in first grade, talking about what they want to do when they grow up. And so Senku's like, I'm going to space. The teacher's like, oh, what a wonderful dream to pursue when you grow up. And Senku's like, no, I'm going as soon as I possibly can. I do enjoy the bluntness. There's a very sad and weird sequence of, like, Senku's father realizing his passion for science and being like, well, if you're serious about this, then I will help you. There's nothing you can't accomplish with science and diligence. You can be sure, at least, that Santa will bring you the tools you need. And it shows him going to a car dealership and tearfully turning over his key to get the money to buy Senku all of this research equipment, and
it's sad, but it's like in a charming way. Like, it's a dad who's willing to sacrifice a lot to basically enable his kid to be the very best he can be, which is nice, since it's kind of the inverse of the relationship Haruma had with his dad.
Yeah, the other shadow-faced dad that Inugaki would write about.
And it makes me sit here, and I'm just like, I hope that there's a follow-up on this, and I really, really hope that, like, Senku's dad is somewhere out in the world that could be saved. I feel like there's a sad story coming where he's going to find his dad's stone statue at some point, like, and it's, like, crushed or something. But it was, you know, a very... It's small. It's not a very heavily focused upon element of this entire chapter, But it was something that I just sat there and just like, it's nice to see a good dad in Shonen Jump. Most of them are deadbeats.
So we see this kind of time progression happening where it starts off with him, you know, on the side of the road playing with a magnifying glass. Ah, it can focus light and it burns stuff. And there's old people going by, oh, what a cute child experimenting. And then shows him later on experimenting with chemicals like, oh, with iron, sand, and aluminum foil, they make this really flammable combination. He's like huddled behind a transparent blast shield. And then there's an old person like, cute. Yeah, kid. Then he comes back later on with a freaking, like, flamethrower, basically, and there's just all people in the background like, what the fuck? But, you know, it shows Senku just rapidly becoming the person that we know him now as this just absurd genius. And we also see him befriending Taiju along the way and see how far back their friendship really goes to when they were probably around, like, 8 years old or something like that.
Seen this shot before. It's kind of been shown to us a few times now, where this idea of like how their relationship was kind of formed is this moment of Senku being protected by Taiju from bullies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's stuff like, you know, he makes this rocket, and Taiju ends up getting Yuzuriha to make little passengers for the rocket. These little dolls to put inside of it. It goes up in the air and it freaking explodes. And I just like, oh, was it a failure? And Senku's like, eh, I got a transmission up there, you know, it's cool. And, so he essentially, his dream is still to go to space. And, so that brings him to where he is now, which of course leaves him with access to far less technology, and staring down a guy who is telling him to relinquish science entirely, or else he'll kill him. And so Tsukasa, you know, repeats the whole thing, like, hey, swear to me that you will give up on science, and I will kill you. And Senku says, that's the only thing I could never do. And Tsukasa takes a breath, and he's like, I knew that would be your answer. And Senku's like, eh, you would have killed me someday, no matter what I said anyway, just in case I could have possibly opposed you. We see Taiju trying to race in to get there in time to save them. Senku just tells Tsukasa, look, you should just kind of like, you know, finish me off really cleanly and quickly, you know. There's no point in, you know, making a mess. And Tsukasa's like, no, I agree, you know. I'll snap your cervical plexus in one blow. You'll lose consciousness and die instantly. I won't make you suffer, and I won't miss. Legit. Thank you.
Yeah, he's like, you know what? It's pretty dope of you.
And Tsukasa says something interesting, which is, if we had only met 3,700 years sooner, if we had met before this planet became a stone world, you just might have been my first friend ever. And Senku says, maybe. And just as Taiju arrives on the scene, there is the sound of a huge crack and Senku falling to the ground.
Quite the interesting chapter.
Yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. There you go.
I loved it, though. So, like the further development into Senku and kind of this conviction behind his passion for science, where it all comes from.
Yeah, everyone has to start somewhere, and he started and he went after it with all the passion that he could muster, and so there is no way he's going to stop now just because there is a weirdly super strong high schooler staring him down. So
I dug it.
I do wonder if maybe he got Tsukasa to kill him in a way that he set something up so he could survive it, or what? But
Well, I've been hearing people who are just like, I really hope they didn't kill Senku. I mean, I guess it's always that case of like, you know, I could say like, yeah, Rebecca's never going to be an important character. Like, you know, I could be very wrong on this notion, but I do feel as though it's one of those situations where we don't see enough of it to the fact that we don't see it deliberately is proof that it didn't happen as we expected. It would feel strange if you were like, yeah, well, I mean, we're 10 chapters into the series. Time to kill one of the two main leads.
It also kind of comes
the more interesting lead.
It also comes with a not too much build, too. So
yeah. So I'm kind of curious, I think, to see what, like, the trick behind this is or what happened. But I think I'm also really curious to see what happens in Taiju's response. Because I've kind of always thought, like, yeah, he's not really, like, the kind of traditional shonen protagonist in the way that, like, he's going to fight against the bad guys to protect his friends. He kind of notes that he's not that kind of person. But it's like, you know, what happens when he can't protect his friends? Something bad happens to one of them. What does he do in response? That kind of, you know, conclusion that I'm interested to see. So, I enjoyed the chapter quite a lot. And I believe it is time for us to move over to We Never Learn, which had two chapters this week, starting with question 10, The Maiden's Genius Day equals X. So this one starts off with a lot of fan service, a particularly healthy amount of it, as we open with Takamoto inside of the girls' locker room changing. And I'm not sure why this, like, confused me so much. I think they're getting changed to go to swim class, and I'm just like, wait a minute. Would you wear your swimsuit underneath your clothes? It seems so, I guess it works. I don't know why. I just feel like that's weird to me for some reason. But regardless, the other girls are basically talking to Takamoto and basically mentioning, like, you have these feelings for Yuga or Yuega. You know, why don't you tell them about it? And she's like, just shut up or everything and, you know, whatever. So they go out later and they're going to try on clothes. Particularly for Takamoto, and she tries on this very frilly dress. And it's just like, oh, you know, like, it looks nice. Her friends are like, yeah, now you can definitely make a move on Yuega. And essentially, she just says, like, oh, no, I couldn't. You know, I don't look right in these clothes. They don't fit me at all. And of course, Yuega shows up. And
can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay, there we go.
Stupid
fucking microphone. I just want to say that opening scene, for the first time I saw it, I was like, is she naked under that shirt? Oh no, it's her swimsuit. Oh, okay.
And her friends essentially just book it. They're just like, oh, Yuega's here. Time to leave her behind and let her, you know, make her move or whatever.
I appreciate that, when they were kind of plotting to, you know, get Ruka dolled up, that they blatantly referred to each other by name, because it's like, I don't know who either of you are, and if you hadn't said each other's names, I would never know who you are.
Yeah. They're just like, this isn't a problem. Would you say Kawase? And she's like, you said it, Yumihara. And I'm like, thank God, I'm gonna remember you two.
Anyway, so Rebecca.
Yeah. So, essentially, the two of them go out on this date, and it's the very traditional, like, I can't believe I'm in pretty girl clothes. I'm just not such a girl at all. But we get an explanation to it, where when Takamoto was a girl, she saw this poster for, like, you could be a princess, too. And she was like, you know what? I'm going to be a princess when I grow up. And her friends, who all seem to be boys, were just like, you got to be kidding. You're not, that ain't your style. Come on, let's go play
You're
cops and robbers.
Come on.
Yeah, and you know, I guess everyone's saying that probably more than just that one instance kind of wore on her, and she just gave up on, you know, being feminine. She just gave up on all the girly stuff. You know, it wasn't right for her. She didn't fit that mold, even though she kind of always wanted it. And you see, like, the entire moment, she's kind of, like, rubbing shoulders with Yuega, and, you know, that notion of, like, oh, it's like we're on a date, but we're not. When Yuega sees, like, this contest going on, and the top prize is this wand that apparently his sister, his little sister, really wants. And we all know Yuega's family's broke as shit, probably can't afford it. So the contest is for couples, and Takamoto's like, hey, you know, I'm a girl, you're a guy, no one has to know we're not a couple, let's just compete.
Yeah. So, and previously, a couple, like, there was a little kid that saw them and was like, oh, they're a couple. And she's like, do we look like that? But, you know, she's like, hey, well, let's use this to our advantage. Why not? So.
But, however, the contest is a princess carry contest where the boys have have to hold up their girls like princesses, and the last one to do it.
And Veruca had just noticed that she was gaining muscle, so she's super heavy now.
Yeah. Which is a far more unlike digestible story of a girl who feels she's gaining weight than what next chapter is about. But
absolutely,
I find it very strange to me that this would be a contest. I don't know if this is a real one, but I'm like, it's weird that there's a contest where, like, to lose, a guy just has to drop a girl from being carried. Like, it's just that's how it's always going to be. Like, oh, I can't do it anymore. Boom! It's just the girl has to fall into the ground. Like, ow! Oh, my spine! Why?
Oh, sorry, honey, but oh, man.
But yeah, this is actually very embarrassing for Takamoto.
Like it's like five men on stage embarrassing themselves in public.
But this is very embarrassing for Takamoto because, one, she's still in that dress that she doesn't feel she's, you know, right for. And she's also being held in a way that she's like, oh, this isn't right at all. And yeah, as you said, she's worried because she's like, I've been putting on muscle lately, so I must feel so heavy and everything like that to him. And Uega is, like, kind of losing it. He's just like, oh, I can't do it anymore. My arms are giving out. But he sees her look of worry and realizes that she's embarrassed. And that gives him the strength to basically keep going because he doesn't want to kind of, like, let her embarrassment go to waste. So they end up winning. And Takamoto basically says, like, hey, do you think I'm kind of dressed like a princess today? Do I look weird like this? And Uega just starts to respond, like, you. And then she just slams the toy into him. He's like, I don't care about your opinion. Bye, Baka. And runs away. He's just like, I guess you really freaked the fuck out there, man. You couldn't hold that shit together for at least two more words?
You would have started making out if you could have held it together for, like, two more minutes, kid.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Did he really seem the guy who's going to be like, fuck you. You were hideous, you monster. And then it ends with, like, the other girls being like, man, you totally blew a great chance. Credits. Next chapter.
I really liked this chapter.
This
one, I have to say.
This one went a good way towards
this
making Takamoto more relatable.
This one and the latter and the second one seemed bound and determined to get me to say that Uruka is, like, at least the second best of the three girls. Because she seems much more relatable. She's not just, you know, defined by, like, how weirdly annoying that she is. She comes across a lot better when she's on her own with Uega than when she does when she's, like, part of the group, it seems. And I do like that. I do like the little moment where she's like, oh, you know, I kind of want to be a princess, but I didn't, you know, it didn't suit me. It's like, aw, that makes me feel bad because...
Yeah.
Who the fuck tells a little kid that they can't be a princess? Fuck you.
Yeah.
You
know? It's the kind of notion that, you know, harems exist to have the girls in them exist really just as kinks and fetishes, like, you know, like personified kinks and fetishes that people can be like, that's my one I go after. So you could enjoy these sorts of series a lot more when you actually put personalities and humanity behind them. And giving Takamoto, who to this point was more of just like a wedgie snapping, interrupting kind of like a loud character, be like, oh, hey, no, she actually has her own conditions and things that she worries about and, you know, insecurities and things like that. You're like, yeah, this is a lot more relatable. And yeah, she didn't spend the whole chapter barging into conversation or grabbing other girls' chests or anything like that. You're like, yeah, I can dig this character significantly more. In contrast, we then have question 11. Said value to a genius is a consequence of X. And it begins with Fumino weighing herself in the morning. And she realizes she's getting fat. She's put on so much weight. And
I've my mass has increased by 10%, which means I've gained 2 pounds.
I'm like, hold on a moment. Let me start doing my math on this.
I'm saying that she is fucking tiny. So.
Well, yeah, it is noted they don't state what that weight is. So you know, you don't have much of a context to how much weight it actually is that she's gained. But yeah, she starts a chapter and like the other girl's like, here are some snacks. She's like, I can't have any weight or anything like that put on. I'm going to be getting fat. And
she realizes because she's been with the study group, they share snacks with her. Iruka always brings treats because, you know, she's got swimming and, Ogata, you know, her family works at the udon place. So she's constantly bringing udon for them. So she's like, oh yeah, let's eat together. No, I'll get fat.
And that just kind of becomes the thing of this chapter is like, even as she's trying to focus, she can't because all the other people in the group are talking about the new food they've made and everything like that. And she's like, why are there, temptations getting so much more intense? And Yueka's like trying to talk to her like, hey, you've been really low energy. Is everything okay? And she's like, I'm totally fine. Stomach gurgle, wargle, wargle. And he finds out that she's, she finds out that she's dieting and he's just like, you know, my sister's doing it too. Why do girls really want to be so thin? You know, it's almost kind of like thrown away, like girls will be girls. And it's like, you know, there's a little bit more to this issue than that, but whatever. I guess we're just going to go past that for now. And she's like, no, if I eat this hard pocket candy you gave me, I'm going to get fat. I'm like, girl, that thing has to have like 6 calories in it. Like there's no way you're going to get fat off this.
It will do nothing to satisfy your hunger, but.
And this is where the chapter takes really kind of like an awkward turn. Cause she's like, my stomach's getting really fat. See, feel it. And she lifts up her skirt and shirt so you can see her belly. And she's like kind of saying like, you know, touch it. Touch my fat old belly. And there's like.
Touch my bare abdomen.
There's like no fat to it first and foremost already. So you're just like, it's like entirely a situation where like as a reader, we're just like, so this is almost like something where it's just supposition to it or whatever. Like it feels like there's no legitimacy to her worry, which again adds to a larger problem that isn't discussed in this whatsoever. But it also just lends itself to this kind of creepy scene where Yuega's just
this
like
this chapter slowly, brought to you by Hero. Like seriously.
Yeah, he's just like slowly being like, I can. To touch it? Oh, but it's so smooth and soft. And, oh.
I don't know if I should touch this.
Yeah, it's this weird moment, and finally she's just like, what do you think? And he's just like, this is bad. Yeah, he just blurts out like, this is bad. So as they're walking home, he's trying to like, you know, take a couple steps back, explain himself, and he imagines what would happen if he was just like, hey, Fumino, there's nothing to worry about, because you're super cute just the way you are. Wink. Uh-huh. And he didn't actually say that. So instead, he just sits there and has, like, nothing at all to her.
Well, it's a great moment because, you know, you start the page, and there's no, like, indication that he's imagining it, so he says that, and Fumino just goes, you're being creepy. And you're just like, oh, I can't actually say that. So.
Yeah, like even in this imagination of how this goes, it ends in, like, ridiculous failure. So he says nothing. And she just goes along, her stomach growling, and he's like, I can't let her do this. So he starts to kind of be like, and Fumito stops him and is like, hold on, I need to buy my midnight snack. And she comes out with, like, this bag of, like, a shit ton of buns. And she's like, what is your diet? And she's like, don't be silly. You burn blood sugar to focus at study night, so I can eat as all as I want without gaining weight. And I actually found this part of the chapter legitimately funny, that it was like, oh, she wasn't actually gaining weight because she was eating more. She was pigging out at the worst time of the day because she had shitty knowledge of how, like, dieting works. So, yeah. Yuega corrects that, tells her what an actual, like, legitimate studying snack would be, and she goes back to living out for life. But this chapter as a whole comes off just unfortunate as like kind of glossing over what the last chapter did well, where it was like, oh, it humanized a character by adding legitimacy to their issue. And it was sort of just like, man, girls sure are silly, concerned about their weight and everything like that. It's like, does it dig at all into the like societal or cultural issues that create that? Or the personality issues that go into it, or the fact that we still haven't really addressed that notion that Fumino's father is a very aggressive and, like a intense person that she finds herself shy to like speak back to and anything like that. None of that's dealt with. It's just like Fumino's so sexy, but she still thinks she's fat.
Oh, she might be a tease when it comes to literature, but she's such a ditz otherwise.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, and it all leads this really weird stomach-touching scene. It's not like I'm saying this is a disgusting, revolting chapter. It's just one of those ones where it's like, you could have done more, and at times I've seen this series take that extra step to do more with this sort of thing, but this felt like a chapter that was just a end goal, let's have this sexy fan service scene.
Like, imagine if the chapter had, like, diverged at a certain point, because there's the joke where Uruka kind of gets back to her old ways, although probably, I think, the funniest example of it so far, because Fumino is asking the others, like, so, do you guys, like, have a problem with, like, gaining weight? And Uruka's like, I never really seem to gain weight, presumably because she, you know, fucking exercises really regularly. And then she's like, and Ogata, I think all the food you eat goes just to your breasts, right? Anyway, so you don't have to worry about it. Just like, it's not that she's like, you've got big tits. She just like says it without fucking thinking.
Just like that notion of like, because you don't get any taller, so all the like growing you do just goes to your tits.
Right. That's right, yeah. Anyway. So,
like, I guess there is only one science girl in this group.
It's true. So imagine if like suddenly at that point the chapter diverged, and instead of Fumino like focusing on like, I'm getting fat and gaining weight, instead Ogata was just like, my tits are getting too big, and she's like starts developing this whole complex about it. And eventually like Yuiga's like, you seem really low energy, why are you so concerned? And Ogata's like, Yuiga, are my tits getting too big? Can you like look, feel them, they're getting too big. Uh-huh. Like that's like it's not that big a leap, honestly.
Yeah.
To go from touching the stomach to it's like creepy and yeah, fan service for the sake of fan service, and there's not a flattering portrayal of the character involved in it. So.
Yeah, it's one of the few things I was really always complimentary on the series about is that Yuiga never came off as like a pervert, because all these situations that came up, he really felt like the butt monkey in them, and never wanted to want to participate in it. And even though in this time he's like, oh, touch her belly, he's really nervous, but it's still the fact that he's doing it, and the entire time he's just like, oh, and her skin's so smooth and soft, and oh, but it feels like I'm doing something bad. But it's just like one of those moments where you wish that they had done something more with this chapter. It felt too easy to just go this route and do nothing with it, and just, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So one good chapter of We Never Learn, and then one less good chapter.
Yep. All right, let's move on to The Promised Neverland.
Let's do it!
Beginning the second arc of the story now that everyone is out of the complex and setting off into the unknown wilderness. It's chapter 38, Forest of Vows. So we begin with Isabella being confronted by demons and a older mother. I don't know. I don't think that's supposed to be grandma.
It might be. There seems to be a little bit more age to the face. So possibly. Because she does say, this isn't like you. And we know grandma had a big expectation of her and almost seemed to think that mom, like Isabella, was unbeatable. So I feel like it should be. But we don't get enough detail to know for certain.
So Isabella says, I take full responsibility for all of this happening. Some of the demons talk about, hey, you know, we've got footsteps along the northeastern bank, so we're sending a party in that direction. Notify everyone in the vicinity. Whoever can capture them alive or even dead will be rewarded handsomely. And we cut to the kids going through the woods. And Ray, in particular, is dumbfounded by, you know, what lies before them, because the trees are completely massive. There is such massive overgrown foliage all through the forest. And he's like, you know, in all the books that we had, there was nothing like this. This is ridiculous. And for a brief moment, he's like, I thought that something moved, which I'm sure won't come back at all at the end of the chapter. Emma calls for the group to take a break because everyone's getting tired from crawling over all the giant, massive roots. And so everyone takes a break, and Emma's thinking, like, everything's gonna be awesome now. We're having our first breakfast after coming outside. We're starting here. and there's going to be a house where we can live in peace and food that we can eat until we're full. I'm going to make it happen. We'll all live together again. I'm going to go back and get Phil and everyone else as soon as possible. And I'm going to have a flying car and a robot husband and...
and superpower robot exoskeleton, a hydraulic penis. I've heard those are pretty dope.
Just imagines like Orihime's me in the future drawing. but she does think like, okay, but you know, we have no idea what's out here. So it's not just the people who are coming after us. There could be wild beasts. There could be other demons out here. We don't know what's waiting for us out here. So she starts to get worried after that. And so Ray, seemingly detecting this, sneaks up behind her and bops her on the head with a jar of water.
Yeah. He's like, yo.
I made sure to use the unbreakable jar so that I wouldn't waste any water because, you know.
He's like, this is actually a filtered jar of water. I know that you guys just drink base water, but that's because you're base people.
Ray, you didn't know about our escape plan. How did you manage to get this? Oh, you know, I made one from weeds and,
my baby
twigs.
Memories. my baby memories and twigs.
This just pops out of his
head. Actually, when you're first born, you know how to make filtered water bottles, but you lose them because you don't have baby memories. But I do have my baby memories, so it's actually pretty
good. Anyway, do you want to hear this song that I learned when I was in the womb? This is the song that I
borrowed. He's like, it's actually become kind of trite, so I'm actually doing a hip-hop jazz remix of it. Because the thing you don't understand about jazz is it's chaotic and fluid at the same time. Everyone's trying to compete over one another. They're like, God damn it! I hate you so much, Ray!
How did you even see that movie? It plays in the womb. You just forget about it.
He's like, you forget about it, but everyone knows how La La Land actually goes at the beginning. That's why all of us really know Moonlight wasn't really the winner. La La Land was. They didn't need the accolade because it's actually beyond
What's
that.
Moonlight?
It's a movie about Sandy hand jobs. They're like, oh, you know what? I'm not going to ask any more questions.
You won't be repulsed by sexuality if you have your baby memories. Anyway. In the real world, Ray provides a bit of encouragement to Emma, says, you know, okay, look, you know, I don't see any, like, footprints or claw marks or anything like that, so there aren't any predatory beasts around here from what I can tell. So, hey, you know, take it easy. You're kind of freaking out right now, so I'll keep watch. You take a rest right now. And then he gives a very genuine apology and says, you know, if I'd been cooperating with you guys from the beginning, you wouldn't have had to like get, you wouldn't have hurt your hand. You wouldn't have lost your ear. And I was like, oh, no, it's no problem. And, but Ray also says, yeah. And I apologize to Anna too, because, you know, she cut her hair in order to help make the decoy. And, he says, you know what she said? Forget that. It's your birthday. Happy birthday. And even though, you know, I was going to leave them behind, they still care about me when I don't deserve it. So I'll live and protect this family, everyone just like you. No matter what happens, I'll never abandon them again. So you don't have to bear this on your own. We'll create a world we can live as a family, all of us. So really just kind of like a reassurance of a point that he kind of made internally during the escape, but... it's nice to see him have the ability to come out of his shell like this. It seems like it's, you know, a real step forward for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Emma says that she plans on checking out a river that's nearby to see if it's got drinkable water. And Ray's like, yeah, we're going to need water because... I mean, I know that we've never really had to do anything like this before, but we'll die in a few days if we don't have any, according to some books I read. So Ray's like, okay, you know, after we, you know, like, get food and water, what are we going to do after that? Like, what's our end goal? Where are we going? And Emma says, well, we're going to go south. We're going to point B0632 to see Mr. Minerva. And Ray's like, what are you talking about? What's that pen? What's point B? What are you talking about? And Emma... gives us the answer for what the hell the deal with the pen is. And so she hands the pen over to Ray and tells him to open it. So he does.
He's like, is this one of those? Oh my god, this is one of those cool pens without any ink. That's so fucking New Valley alt. This is great. I always thought pens had too much ink in them.
Who looks at a pen and thinks, this needs ink in it, seriously?
I'll tell you who thinks that and doesn't actually believe it. It's the people with real woke memories, baby memories.
You know what's totally retro right now, though? Gel pens. Gel pens went out of style way before their time.
You know what the other thing that's super cool now is? Pencils that have heat-sensitive sides on the end so you can see where you've been holding them. They're like mood rings, but cooler because it's not actually your mood.
Oh, my God. Just open the pen ring.
No, I have a whole essay about this in my mind that I'm going to give you. I actually wrote it when I was a baby, but I don't know if you know this.
I have baby memories. I would have written... Ray, you didn't have motor control sufficient in order to hold a pen. Well, you see, I developed this entire way of writing.
I actually developed a way of writing that was actually kind of just a way of immature sonar. Kind of, you know, humans aren't that far devolved from whales,
Here, I'll demonstrate it for you right now. Wah. Wah.
Emma's just sitting on the ground crying. She's like, I hate them so much.
I should have let you burn yourself to death.
I hate you so much.
I vow that we'll all get to live together as a family so that I can educate you all on how to live and be woke like me. Oh, God, we were so much better off without you.
I hate you so much, Ray.
So... Ray opens up the pen, sees the B020632 thing that Emma was talking about, and then Emma says, hey, pull it out a little bit more. And when he does, it displays a fucking hologram in the sky that has the symbol of Minerva, which is B01 through 14. It's the Morse code around in a circle. Ray asks for, what the hell it is. But at that moment, one of the kids, Toma, notices that his buddy, Ronnie, is missing. And he comes crying for Emma and says, oh, Ronnie disappeared. And Emma's like, what are you talking about? Were you, like, attacked? Did you saw each other? And Toma says, no, we were right next to each other and he disappeared. I turned around and he was gone in an instant. And, so... they start calling out for him and trying to get him to answer. There's no response. Emma says, I'm going to go find him. And Ray says, hang on a second. Because something's not right here. And he says, look, no one else is reacting to us calling his name. No one else is hearing us. And there's like only four of them there. And so they run back to where Don and Gilda and the rest of the kids were all gathered up having their little picnic. And they realize that everyone is missing. Mm. So, dun, dun, dun.
It's a glimpse at seeing that the world outside the farms is not as simple as it was perhaps believed. There are
maybe the living plants from Astra are here.
Oh, my God.
You have to throw a dark sheet on them. It's good, but it's definitely like a setup chapter.
Yes.
Because we've gotten great chapter after great chapter after great chapter after great chapter of Promised Neverland. And this one, I mean, did it just sound like up to par? But it's not really disappointing because you knew that after coming off of such a strong finish like that, okay, we've got to build it up again. So... it's not a particularly impressive chapter, but honestly, like in a weaker series, this would be a good chapter.
Yeah, so. I enjoy this chapter simply from the fact that it's told in an interesting way, and I promise Neverland needed to kind of fall back a little bit. It couldn't keep being like crazy intense every week, especially if it was going to build up the world to be anything, the outside world to be something exciting. You can't just do that all at once.
Right, so, we're back to everything being unknown for the kids again.
Yes. So, let's move on to the Seven Deadly Sins, chapter 217, Where the Heart Is. So, last chapter, all of the sins gathered together. They're like, in your chest, that's where it is! all the sins gathered together again. And, Diane's talking about like, oh, it's great to see you guys all together again. Oh, only the captain were alive. And he's like, I'm under your butt! but yeah, they're like, holy crap, you know, we're all back. The king actually is like, oh, I'm so glad to see that you're all here. And
he gets cut off like twice in the chapter when he's trying to make a dramatic entrance. And they just ignore him.
Yeah, they think initially, because they haven't seen Melodius get up yet, that they're like, oh, God, it's the captain's ghost. For some reason, like, they're just like, he got old.
You know, this is like, what are you talking about? I'm still alive. Ah!
Vaughn and Melodius make fun of the fact that King's wings are really tiny, but they congratulate them still. And they also note that this is something to be very excited about because Diane's got her memories back, and that's very exciting. And Gowther's like, impossible. Memories can't be gained back. But Diane says no, because if...
Zach, what are you doing here? Are you?
Which one? I don't know. If you have precious memories,
so many robots,
deep in your soul, even if you forget them or they become hazy, they will never go away. And
you can get them back.
Yeah, she mentions that the one who brought you into this world told me that. So I'm going to fulfill my promise to him from 2,000 years ago and get your soul back. And I kind of like how they're just like glossing over the fact that she's like, yeah, we were back 2,000 years. Like, Lodius, like, Diane just said 2,000 years ago. Bond's like, eh, must be dreaming. And they just don't address it anymore beyond that. They're just like, eh, whatever. But they know, like, yeah, the old Gowther used to have a soul and we're going to get it back. Like, I found your heart. Remember, that was taken from him. And we're going to give it back to you. But before they can't, Gowther, like, leaps off of the castle and starts running away. He transforms.
Gowther's basically just like, don't want to buy me.
Yeah. No. He like leaps off. He transforms so that he can like, you know, hide himself amongst the crowd and like kind of gets himself all alone. And he sees the castle and he's just like, why did I come here? You know, and he starts having flashes to the side story we saw that showed kind of what happened to Gowther, what gave him his deadly sin, all those moments. And as he's having them, he's like, I can't understand why I'm having these. And if I can't get to the reason why, then I will get rid of them. And you can see he's about to erase his memories before he's interrupted by Diane, who flying missile drop kicks him, I guess getting shrunk along the way, because if she was full size.
She asked specifically for Merlin to shrink her down so that she could actually pursue Gowther through the alleys.
Yeah, so she shows up and flying missile drop kicks him to stop him from doing it. And
no!
That's where
the... like, that kind of hurt. He's well, like, well, I'll just do it now.
Uncomfortable. But yeah, that's where the chapter ends, as she stops Gowther from erasing his own memories. I like this chapter. Nothing like spectacular happens in it, but it is kind of a follow up to what happened in that flashback. This is a consequence of it that I'm glad they're not going to wait on. They're kind of like going to address it and get it out of the way before we move on to the next part of the story.
So. And there's some fun interactions, like you mentioned, the stuff with Meliodas, them thinking that he's dead, and then it turns out he's not dead, of course, and. Some of the comments that Bond makes, and also the king. I am going to turn you around, my bro.
Come on! I had totes.
Perfect opening I had right there.
I had a totes cool line to drop on you.
So, fine chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go over to Black Clover. So, last time, Mirio Leona, decided to bring her Crimson Lion King's group and, some hangers-on to, special mountain training, volcano training, because she says, as she explains, as they're looking at the summits of these huge volcanoes looming, in front of them, ah, the summit. There is a magnificent revitalizing hot spring. So, come on, let's go up there. And they're like, okay.
Don't wanna, though.
So, she says, like, yeah, if you can make it up there, then you can chill in the hot springs, essentially. So, she kicks out Asta and Leo and is like, get out of there, go. And immediately they start to get overwhelmed by the heat. And a bunch of the lower level guys are like, Jesus Christ, this is crazy. Like, the atmospheric mana is going berserk. It feels like my body is going to explode. But Charlotte and Yami race off ahead of everyone. And so they are cutting their way through a bunch of, you know, the ash and molten rock that's hitting their way. And they're basically completely unperturbed by the overwhelming atmosphere of the heavy volcano. And at that moment, Leo was like, oh, I get it. They're using their mana to project this protective layer around themselves. So that's what they're doing. It requires a lot of control to exude mana in that way.
It's
mana skin.
It's amusing to me the way this is delivered, because it's that moment where Leo's like, I've got it! They're wearing a layer of protective mana, but it's for something that is then explained to be something every magic knight is meant to be capable of. So like the very like notion that this one ubiquitous magic that all knights share is something that he's like, I didn't even think of that. It's like, why wouldn't you? It's supposedly the one thing you are all at the base minimum supposed to be able to do.
They introduced, like, because, you know, some of the other guys are like, well, yes, all magic knights use that technique. Anyway!
like, just one of those things that you'd be like, oh, right, I should be using my... They're just using mana skin. But it because it's a shonen, it has to be delivered in that way, like, oh, I got it! He's using mana skin! Why didn't I think of that? Yami's so skilled!
They explained that the problem is that I guess it's used in bursts. Mm-hmm. And so they explain, like, it'd be really difficult to maintain it long term, and also to do it in a harsh environment, it's going to be really difficult. But Leo's just like, no, we can do it! Yuno adapts pretty quickly because he's fucking Yuno. The woman in Charlotte's team is also there, and she's like, I'm gonna be just like Sis, and then I'm gonna soak in the hot spring with her.
Okay.
This fucking woman better also have a really compelling goddamn backstory, because
hopefully.
Yeah. Yami kind of realizes, that woman, she actually had a reason for bringing us along on this trip. She wanted us to serve as examples, especially Charlotte, because she's got a really bad affinity to this place. So she's got to essentially use her magic skin perfectly. So she's the perfect example for everyone to follow here. Mm-hmm. But we see that some of the members of the training group are actually really, really struggling. Noelle, for example, and she's really thinking like, oh man, like I should have really good affinity for this because I use water magic, so I should have an advantage here, but I just don't have good control. So Maria Leona happens to come across her, and she says, I can tell from your mana, you used to simply be afraid of your siblings, but you've changed. If you've resolved to reach the top, hurry and show me you can get to the summit of a little mountain like this one. Nothing is stronger than a determined woman, like your mother.
In case you didn't know, mana comes with trivia facts like an IMDb page. It just told me the history of what your, like, inner personality has been like. I'm like, all right.
I can sense it coming off of you.
It's like, we just met today, though, didn't we?
So, Noah gets encouraged by this, and then, of course, there's Asta, who's like, got no magic.
I can't cut.
My sword doesn't work on this. It's not magic.
I can't cut hot weather.
So, Mario Leona is just like, you can head back. You've got no magic. You know, you could never climb this mountain. They say you're the number two rookie, so I thought you had something, but I guess your previous exploits were all luck. That luck of yours is magnificent. If you have something like that, you may manage to become Wizard King, even without climbing this mountain. Now that you understand that, go home. And Asta's like, no!
Okay.
And that was how Asta got horrifically burned and died. So
she's like, I mean, it's not really fair. You're just going to incinerate. Like, it's not like you can't just get through this with pure exertion. Like, that's like saying you could just go through a wall if you believed hard enough. It doesn't. All right. Whatever.
It does seem odd that she brought everyone to, like, to give them this intense training to master a particular technique of endurance and mana manipulation. And then there's Zesta, who's like, well, I mean, you literally can't use that technique. So maybe you shouldn't. And I guess she did this to just see what he would do because she's curious and that's why she brought him along, but.
And you know what? It's fine. Like, it's the notion of another situation where not having magic has put Asta behind, but he's going to prove that he's going to surpass that because he is destined to be the Wizard King. And that's kind of fine. I just think my concern here is this situation as presented last week seemed like it was going to be this intriguing way to give us a glimpse at a bunch of new characters and their struggles, including captains that we hadn't gotten a lot of detail on. But like, Yuno and Leo kind of like immediately figured out what to do and are going with it. And there was a little bit with Noelle, but I feel like that may not have, like, look, we don't know what's going to happen in the next couple of weeks, but my worry is like, is this just meant to be mostly a story about can Asta do it? Cause I'm not that interested in that. I'm interested to see if there's development here for Leo and Charlotte and God forbid, you know, but if this is just going to be another story about how Asta got his groove back and, you know, managed to keep up with all the great magic users, I'm going to be like, I mean, we've seen this. This isn't like a new story at all. Like even really the Noelle story isn't new for us. I mean, this has been like a B plot in the past two arcs for her. So I was kind of more interested in seeing these other characters do things, and I hope we still do, but as it's kind of presented here, it doesn't look like Yuno or Leo are having a big issue. Now, again, that could change. Next week, that might be the situation. I'm just saying from this one, I'm just like, eh, it's a little bit repeating that we're doing the same territory again, and I'm less interested in seeing that, more or less.
I mean, here's the thing. This is because Mario Leona never says this is specifically for like, you know, magic skin training. Presumably there was the thought of, oh, well, I'll bring these captains who can demonstrate technique that the Magic Knights will, you know, be able to get inspired by, and we'll bring this rookie guy so that, you know, his peers will be like, oh, I need to do better and stuff like that. But that means that she's presenting them this open challenge that can be approached, presumably, from a number of different angles. So, you know, like, if Naruto were to do something like this, then of course there would be, you know, Rock Lee, who can't use frickin' ninjutsu or genjutsu, who would have to find some way to overcome those things and just, you know, do things his way. But in that type of thing, you would presume that everyone would come up with a different way to do something. You know, each of them would use their specialty in a creative way so that they could accomplish the task. Whereas in this one, everyone except Asta is doing the same technique. So it's, I get what you mean, is that it's, if there were, you know, Yuno did something and then Leo did something and Noelle did something, then that would be fine. But instead it was just like, oh, we just need to use magic skin. Well, Asta can't use magic skin. What unique path will he specifically, only him, come up with in order to get up there?
Yeah. And I really want to reiterate, you know, this is entirely base reactions to this chapter. We, you know, we don't know how the next ones are going to go. The next chapters may address this entirely and develop those. I'm just noting, in response to this chapter, I'm like, I hope that isn't the situation that happens where we don't get any more real follow-up to everyone else. It's just a story about Asta.
And I like that we got to see that Melio Leona is, she's more clever than she initially seemed, and that she does have more than one approach to getting people inspired. She's not just, you know, the super awful drill sergeant type of character. She has more positive reinforcement. She also has reverse psychology on her side. So she's more capable than initially seemed to be, which is good.
Absolutely.
So, let's get over to One Piece.
Let's do it.
Chapter 865, Hey Mother.
Hey Mother, it's an endless world that we discuss. It's a Hey Brother. Adichie, Nick. Come on. You gotta stay up with the new tunes. Come on, Nick. What are you... Don't drink your water like you're shunning me and my sweet reference. It was fitting. It was current. It was unique. Fine, fuck you.
I don't listen to Anyway, it's still chaos at the wedding. At this point, Mother Carmel's portrait has been shattered, but Big Mom is still in her weird, like, hasn't quite freaked out yet thing. So we cut around to a couple of different places. For example, Caesar Clown sets up the escape mirror outside of the facility and waits. Luffy picks up the remains of the picture. People are reacting because, you know, the animals that are disguised as Luffy are still running around. The cake is collapsed. Katakuri goes after Beige and tries to put a stop to everything. We go over to Judge and his family, and Judge is, of course, really, really pissed off because they're frozen in place with the candy coating, and they can't resist all of the Big Mom pirates who have enclosed around them. Peros is mocking him with his tongue.
Pero, 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 pero.
Sanji actually shouts out to Reiju and tries to convince her to run away, and Reiju's like,
"Meh." Nah.
I mean, that's a simplification of it, but she, you know, him, and she says, "I overlooked your kind nature. Now you won't even run for safety and leave us behind. But I feel like this, my heart has been redeemed at last. There is still a conscience to be found in our bloodline, so thank you for that." Beige and Katakuri start to fight. Beige fires a bunch of bullets straight into Katakuri's head, but he is this weird candy man, so it doesn't work. Katakuri starts to kick some ass. He extends his candy out, tries to attack Luffy and stop him from getting the portrait. Pedro intercepts it. Jinpei uses some techniques with his water to try and keep him at bay. But Katakuri is pretty damn persistent, and he manages to pin Luffy down. Fortunately, Luffy's made of rubber. Yo-ho-ho. And he snaps his arms out, holding the remains of the picture, and puts them right in front of Big Mom's eyes. And she actually grabs the picture and starts to cry over it. And sure enough, she lets out this huge shout. And everyone who's not wearing their special, super awesome, mega advanced earplugs. Yeah, big reaction page of that, everyone clutching their ears and falling over. Then she falls to her knees. Her knees bleed just as Beige had said that they would. And his men start to get their poison rocket launcher thingies ready.
Nice.
Go ahead. At that moment, suddenly Chopper appears in front of Reiju and pops some earplugs into her ears, and Sanji uses his flaming foot stuff to set his family free. Burns away the candy coating.
It's actually a little bit of a shame, because this would have been, I feel like, an awesome scene for a two-page spread, because it's an awesome-looking visual of Sanji staying on a table and his fist or his feet just aflame. And that, like, cool pose. But I love this visual of, like, Sanji just almost standing in flames as his family's kind of freed from it. I know that the...
He stood in fire but didn't get burned.
Like, I know they didn't... It wasn't what was went with, because 2 pages earlier, there was a 2-page spread essentially for Big Mom's moment, and that's perfectly fine to get it. But I was like, man, I really wish we could have, like, seen more of, like, a standalone visual for that shot of Sanji, because it's an awesome, like, image.
I get your point, yeah. It's a really cool moment for Sanji, you know, as horrible as his family has been to him. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm saving you assholes.
Looks like he...
I look like a boss doing it.
And it looks like he also brought their suits for them, too, because he hands them all canisters with their number on it.
Mm-hmm. So people are getting ready to go. Beige and his men have the rocket launchers pointed at Big Mom. And then we start to get a flashback as Big Mom kind of assembles the picture in her mind and remembers her mother. And she thinks to herself, nobody will hear me out. Hey, mother, where did you go? Why did you just up and vanish? And we begin a flashback to 63 years ago in the New World, Elbaf.
I'm super stoked for this. One Piece flashbacks are usually very good for adding a lot of characterization. I think it's cool. We're getting a little bit more about Big Mom. There were enough clues out there to kind of piece together there was something about this, how she didn't have any giants in her family, even though she noted it, how she wanted everyone to be the same size so they could sit on an equal level. But more than anything, I'm just really excited to see more of Elbaf. I mean, this is something that's been teased in One Piece, I think, since back in... I think it maybe was first brought up during Alabasta. Or no, it was brought up way before that in Little Garden, actually, because that was where they met the giants. So, I mean, that's crazy long time ago we've been hearing about this place, and we're finally going to be seeing some real glimpse of it, I think. So I'm super stoked to see more of that, even though it's going to be 2 weeks until it happens.
Yep. One Piece is off next week.
You cocksucker, Oda. He's like, come on, man. I'm like, I know. I really want to find out.
Do it now.
Yeah, do the chapter now. I don't get any world trigger still, so.
Yeah, good point. And that is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap this week. Had a good time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lots of good chapters. Let's pick our favorites. Chapter of the week, MVP.
This is a little bit tough. I'm going to go with my chapter of the week is going to be Dr. Stone, I think. I really enjoyed it this week, and I thought it was nice to get that glimpse into Senju and everything revolving around that. So I really, really dug that. Senku, sorry.
I went with Astra, Lost in Space. I thought it was a very amusing chapter, and honestly went in the direction that I was completely not expecting that it would go in at this point. Going with that. And my character of the week, though, is Senku. It was a great little sequence to just show, like, hey, you know, this is the character that he is. This is why he's freaking choosing death over obeying Tsukasa's demand. So.
And I dig that. I dig that a lot. By the way, the MVP or the character, weekly poll gave it to One Piece this week. And I think that's perfectly viable. Almost every chapter this week, I think, was a legitimate like contender. I don't think there's any chapter I was really like, oh, man, this was great.
Except for the second chapter we never learned.
Yeah.
But the first one, you know.
Yeah, but I had to take the part and parcel. I guess to that extent, I might give my character MVP to Takamoto, because this was a week where I felt like we got some real development forward. I really legitimately enjoyed that. So I'm glad that I can, at least for this brief period of time, this brief window, say I enjoyed her more legitimately as a character.
Yeah, absolutely. Breaks the nearly 2 month long. Well, no, hang on. Yeah, the nearly 2 month streak of Promise Everland winning the weekly poll for the chat as a comparatively weak chapter lost out finally to One Piece.
Yeah. By the way, I'll note this for people who are listening to this after the fact. Again, if you ever want to vote in this, I try to get these up ahead of time, though this week I only got this up like minutes before we began. I'm going to try to get these polls up earlier, so even if you aren't able to make the live episode, you can still vote. But just to note, with the way Smashcast does polls now, they're kind of like status responses, almost like a Twitter feed. So past polls are going to remain there. So you can actually go back and scroll through those now, essentially, if you ever want to take a look and see kind of over time how things are, if you aren't keeping like a runny tally yourself.
Okay. All right.
Let's wrap this up.
Yeah. This is the same every week. I should know how to do this. Hang on. All right, yeah. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here on Hitbox.tv. No, it's not Hitbox.tv. What am I talking about? Smashcast.tv/RollOT. Also, Twitch.tv/RollOT. Hitbox will, however, still forward to this stream, so yeah. I guess that works too. We record the show, generally speaking, around 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Wednesdays. If something needs to change, though, we'll let you guys know, and we'll do that through Twitter. Yes. At DBMR Podcast is the podcast stream. At RoloT, at Y Ruler of Time are your host's Twitter accounts. And also, you can check out our past episodes. You can check them out on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, on iTunes, and on our YouTube channel. And hey, if you check it out on iTunes, make sure you leave a comment and rating so that you can help us beat the woodworkers in the hobby section.
And in the same way, if you're checking out on YouTube, make sure to put a subscribe in if you want to catch up on those videos and help us out. Because it absolutely
and help
does.
Us beat the Let's Players. Which
the woodwork.
Hope on that front.
I hope there's a woodworker Let's Play out there. Like he's like, let's carve.
Hey, buddy, and welcome to Let's Cut.
Oh, I gotta check this out right now. I hope there's like a Let's like live wood carving fucking YouTuber Christ. Who's just killing us.
Special thanks go out to all of our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We recently recorded the May Q&A episode, and we'll have more stuff up soon for you guys to check out.
Yes.
You can also...
Yeah, by the way, special thanks to Bass Forever, who is a new patron for us. Thank you very much, Bass. It is greatly appreciated.
If you want to suggest a future manga for us to read, if you want to ask us a question for us to answer on a Q&A episode, or even if you just want to provide general feedback, you can send all that stuff to our email, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com.
Somewhere up there.
Yeah. Special thanks go out to Steve Mann, our talk artist, and also to Infamous Planet, who made the new frame that you're seeing on the video version of the stream. Thank you.
He also, I don't know if we mentioned this before the stream or not, but if you haven't seen
we did it before, but we haven't mentioned it on the recording yet.
So yeah, if you go to Infamous Planet's YouTube, or not YouTube, Twitter, which is twitter.com/InfamousPlanet, he created an opening for Weekly Manga Recap based off of the Marvel Studios opening. We are not going to be including it in the opening of these podcasts simply because they are probably the copyright infringement at that point. So we aren't able to include it, but you can check it out. It is his YouTube, and it is extremely awesome, and I do want to try to see if we can find some way to implement that. But if nothing else, at least check it out and maybe give him a follow on Twitter.
And, I think that's going to do it. So, thanks, guys. We will see.
Real quick,
you want to name what we're going to do next? Yes.
This
is also going to be a special one.
Yes. So. We've missed that for the past few times. We've left and everyone was in suspense. So, our next recommendation is going to be a little bit of a special one, guys, because this isn't technically going to be a series that for us is new, but this is something that is going to be a little bit different and maybe something we'll continue doing in the future, but we're going to be doing essentially a reread of something. And that is, because of the upcoming Death Note movie, our next recommendation is going to be Death Note, as Nick and I reread a series.
I'm just going to hit because you're like, because of the upcoming Death Note movie, we are going to be rereading just like something completely different.
Yeah, you're like, we're rereading.
We are going to be rereading.
We're reading Air Gear. We're rereading Even a Monkey Could Draw Manga. But this is a series that I think we both have strong feelings for, but we haven't read it in, it's probably been about a decade or so for me. So it's been a while. We're going to see how it holds up, and I think it'll be fun to talk about. Extra little bonus to it, if you guys want to follow along, they're actually doing a digital sale right now on this on Shonen Jump, so you can pick up the digital volumes at a cheaper price, and it might be worth it to pick those up if this is a series you take. So stay tuned for that, and we'll have our Death Note episode coming up very soon. All right. Now we're headed out. Let's hit the old dusty trail, Nick.
Let's saddle up.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Saddle up there, cowboy. I got shot, Nick. Bury me with my money.
You didn't get shot. Your gun just went off because you don't take care of him.
I plaxico burst myself, Nick. I'm not going to make it.
No wonder you didn't make a good cowboy.
Oh.